Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to start now, if we may. Welcome to the second Merck Foundation lecture. And first of all, I'd like to thank the Foundation and MSD UK for aiding this event. Before I introduce the speaker, let me just tell you how the event will run. The main speaker will speak in a moment. I'll say something about his background in a moment. And then a response is going to be given by Professor Tim Besley, who is a Professor of Economics and Political Science and Director of Stickard, a major research centre here at the London School of Economics. And I thank Tim for that because I know his time's incredibly busy. And then after that response, there will be a short period of time available for some questions from the floor, but given the opportunity cost, keep the questions small and direct, please. So with that, it's my real pleasure to introduce the main speaker for the lecture this evening, Professor Angus Deaton, who's one of the foremost microeconomists in the world at present. He's the Dwight Eisenhower Professor of International Affairs and Professor of Economics and International Affairs at Princeton. Also a fellow of the British Academy, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the Econometric Society. His major current research interests are in the area of health, economic development, poverty, and the analysis of household behavior. And I suppose he's particularly well known for his applied microeconomics work, especially his work on surveys. And if you don't have his rather dated book now, Analysis of Household Surveys, it's a real gem, and I would think that you ought to buy it. He's a British citizen, a fellow Scot, but of course now he resides in the United States, and he's given up his Thanksgiving to be here today, so it is a real pleasure to introduce Angus to give a talk on Health and Age of Globalization. Thanks, Angus.
Thank you very much for that. All right, for those of you who've ever been expatriates and been through an American Thanksgiving, you'll know that I was delighted to accept this invitation. I also have changed the spelling on my slides, even though my version of PowerPoint doesn't like this. So here is what I'm going to talk about. The overarching theme, I want to argue that economists have been a little bit too positive about the effects of globalization on international health, and particularly in poor countries, when at least they've thought about it at all. The sort of major thing you get by reading the economics literature on globalization is how little reference there is to international health by economists, at least. There are several books on globalization, sort of surveys of globalization now and in history, where you will not find the word health anywhere in the index. That, of course, is very different from epidemiologists, which is something I'll come to. So what I'm going to talk about is like this. I want to talk a little bit about the history. This is so much fun that I could spend all night talking about it, but I'll try not to. I want to talk about what's actually happened in the last 50 years, where we've got some reasonably good data to look at. I want to talk about income growth, global health, and global health inequalities. And I want to think about the welfare consequences of what's been happening to life expectancy around the world. And then I'm going to spend quite a bit of time talking about the transmission of health knowledge and technology within rich countries and between rich and poor countries. And then at the very end, because the Woodrow Wilson School is a public policy school and I'm paid to think about policy, I'm going to just say a few words about some of the policy things, policy recommendations that might come out of the way I've been thinking about this. So let me go all the way back and talk about one of the first waves of globalization, which economists don't really like to think about very much, but it's very important in the epidemiology literature. One of the things I repeatedly get in students at Princeton, they'll come and say, "Professor Deaton, I've taken 5 development courses, and the word colonization has not come up yet. Was I brought up in some strange place?" Well, yes, you were. Princeton, or most economics departments. So most of what's here, I think, is very familiar. The decimation, in some cases, elimination of populations in Americas and Oceania as epidemiologically, populations that had been epidemiologically isolated from Europe came into contact with Europeans for the first time. One of the things that's interesting is when the Portuguese first moved into South Africa, the effects were really much more limited, largely because Africa has not been epidemiologically or not so epidemiologically isolated as the Americas had been. The other important part of the colonial story that has to do with disease has been recently argued by Acemoglu and Johnson, which is that unhealthy places like Africa and India got, quotes, bad extractive colonization, while the healthier places like America and Australia and New Zealand and South Africa, Canada, where Europeans could settle, got good settler colonization. And that the consequences of this are still with us and still determinative of the income distribution of the world as a consequence. One of the more the strongest arguments from that literature, which goes back in the historical literature too, is that places that were once rich are the places that are now poor. So that if you were a rich place or a seen to be rich place like West Bengal, you attracted colonists or colonialists who couldn't settle there and whose extractive activities turned the place into what it relatively is now, which is a much poorer part of the world. Emma Rothschild tells the wonderful story that the East India Company was one of the causes of the American Revolution, something that Americans are not widely taught. But there was a great famine in Bengal in 1770, in which perhaps a third of the population died. The East India Company did not see fit to suspend the collection of taxes during that famine, and the word of that and of the generally rapacious behavior of the company became a scandal in Britain and was a scandal in the colonies. And the new colonists thought that Bengal had been a really rich place, which the East India Company had turned into a really poor place by the taxation policies of the company, and it seemed to them that if they didn't do something about it, they were next on the list. And Emma Rothschild has carefully documented the historical evidence for those conjectures. I also don't want to paint an entirely negative picture, because that would not be accurate. One of the important offsets, for instance, you could list many, and this is much more like trade today, was the importation and introduction of American foods into Africa slowly between the 16th and the 19th century, and particularly corn and cassava, which generate calories much more cheaply and effectively than do sorghum and millet in African conditions. And this probably did a lot for the health of Africa, though most of it would have shown up in terms of demographic growth and the size of populations rather than in terms of increased life expectancy. Another theme which runs through this literature are the links between public health on the one hand and trade on the other. The trade involves the movement of people and goods, and that inevitably brings unwelcome visitors in terms of the transmission of disease. Ever since the outbreaks of plague in Europe, and perhaps even before that, public health officials and traders and merchants have been in perpetual conflict with one another over the appropriate public health measures that should be imposed to deal with outbreaks of disease. Carlo Cipolla has written several volumes about the plague in Tuscany and the international relations involved between Florence and Genoa, for instance, and the pretexts of plague and the pretexts of disease in order to set up which were effectively non-tariff barriers to trade and the reactions of the merchants and so on. Cholera in Europe throughout the 19th century, which sort of was the plague, was to the 19th century what the plague had been to the 14th century. You encounter very similar stories. Another part is the yellow fever in the American South prior to 1900, with cities essentially going to war against one another, or getting close to going to war against one another, over the restrictions of trade that were seen to be arbitrary and unfair. In nearly all of these battles, the merchants finished up on top, which is perhaps not a great surprise. Though one of the interesting stories about this is that once the transmission of these diseases were better understood, for instance, after Walter Reed isolated or determined the mosquito basis of yellow fever in 1900, or cholera after Koch and Snow, the public health measures could become much more precise and much better supported, and there was much less difficulty in persuading the merchants that these were actually necessary. And the conflict between public health and trade diminished somewhat, though those conflicts remain even now from familiar cases. If you ask an economist what it is that defines globalization, one of the answers they'll give you is that it's lower transport costs. And lower transport costs are indeed one of the fundamental causes. But it's clear that lower transport costs and faster transportation also make it much more difficult to control disease. Perhaps the obvious case is that shipboard quarantines, for instance, would work in days when the length of the voyage was longer than the incubation period of the disease. That's no longer true once you're on a train as opposed to a ship, as people found out very quickly in Europe during some of the cholera epidemics in the 19th century, when people who didn't know they were infected would get off in a city hundreds of miles away before they knew they were affected. We're familiar with that now in terms of AIDS and the more recent episode of SARS. And once again, if the WHO at least argues that globalization and the tools of globalization, such as the internet, have made it much easier for them to monitor the outbreaks of the disease. So for instance, the WHO knew something was going on in China before the SARS epidemic was officially reported to them by the Chinese authority, essentially by various webworms and other sort of things that pick up unusual things that are going on. The last argument I want to deal with in this section is the WHO, the Jeff Sachs, the Commissioner on Macroeconomics and Health argument that Africa is poor because of poor health, and that its ability to participate in the global economy is limited by its lack of human and health capital. And in fact, this argument, even among the economists, you'll see from time to time, the World Bank, for instance, in its book on globalization and trade, argues that good health and good education are prerequisites for successful globalization. And that if you don't have those before you start, then opening up your markets is likely to make to not improve welfare, but make things worse off. One of the long-term arguments here is that in Africa, unlike anywhere else, man and his parasites co-evolved, which leads to a sort of perpetual equilibrium in which there's a very high burden of chronic disease. So the other equilibrium, which there are people and no bugs, or bugs and no people, can't happen in Africa because of the way they evolved together. And so that chronic disease is sort of a deeply evolved part of African life, and that in itself is a bar to economic growth. One of the things I want to draw attention to here is that this argument is one in which health drives income rather than income driving health. And this sort of two-way causality, which of course people have been quarreling about for a very, very long time, is part of, I think, all of these stories, whether we're talking about international health or whether we're talking about health inequalities in domestic health. So if you can take some contemporary views, the epidemiological literature, if I can characterize it by one sentence, is that globalization is completing the unfinished work of colonization, and that's not a positive statement. The economist's view, if you can characterize it, is perhaps the title of the famous Pritchett and Summers paper. Larry Summers, who was then the chief economist of the World Bank and later became the Secretary of the Treasury, wrote a paper called Wealthier is Healthier, in which they basically argued that if you had economic growth, then people would be healthy, and that was sort of the end of it. And it was clear that that became very close to the official policy of the United States. And one of the things I'd like to talk about first, or at least first in this more substantive section, is whether that's true, what is the evidence, and Something that I think is really important in this literature, people are so far apart on these questions, like a globalization and poverty, globalization and inequality, globalization and health, that just getting the facts straight is actually a very important prerequisite to rational debate about these things. In fact, that turns out to be much harder than you might think. So here is one of my all-time favorite graphs. People will tell you I'm incapable of giving a lecture without showing a version of this graph. This graph was first drawn by Samuel Preston in his Princeton PhD thesis in the early 70s, though he was using much earlier data. These data are from around 2000. And what this is a plot of is that life expectancy of birth in 2000 against GDP per capita measured in current purchasing power price dollars. So this is roughly as comparable as we can get from GDP, and the life expectancy, of course, has its units, natural units of years. So the thing to notice about this, which has deeply affected the whole nature of this debate for 30 years, is that among the poorest countries, to the left of the picture here, you've got a very, very sharp and steep relationship between life expectancy and income. So that for per capita incomes up to about $5,000 a year, then it seems that if you wanted to interpret this as a sort of causal relationship, which of course we shouldn't, that there's a very strong relationship between income and health. And you know, intuitively that makes a lot of sense. You think of these people as not being very well nourished, having poor sanitation, having contaminated water supplies, and that money would make a big difference at that sort of level of development. Beyond $5,000, this curve really flattens out a lot, and arguably it's pretty much sort of flat at the top, though a lot of this depends on the United States, which of course, as we all know, has rather low life expectancy relative to its income level. In fact, it's pulling down the curve at the top there. There's one other country that's not on the picture, which is Luxembourg, which is somewhere over there somewhere. Though what the purchasing power parity GDP per capita for Luxembourg means, I'm not entirely sure. Let me say a couple more things about this in preparation. The size of these blobs on here are proportional to the population of the countries. So you can see that India and China are the two really big circles around the hinge of this picture here. The USA is pretty big up at the top. Russia and Brazil, you see in there too. The hinge, of course, is the point of the epidemiological transition. To the left of $5,000 a year, people are dying largely from infectious diseases. To the right of that hinge, people are largely dying of chronic diseases. In one account, you're moving from disease of children's bowels to diseases of old people's arteries as you go from the left to the right of the picture. This curve has got a dent in it now that didn't used to be there. When Preston drew this, it was a much smoother curve. And that dent is the contemporary effect of the collapse of health in sub-Saharan Africa. And you can see South Africa right down. It's a big country there with life expectancy below 50 and a relatively high per capita income. And you can see Brazil. You can also see Russia, which is not driven down there by AIDS, but that was the sort of collapse of health in the 90s in Russia. South Africa is an interesting case to look at, because when I first saw this graph, I used to think, well, the reason South Africa is way out there is, that's right here, is simply because it's really a much poorer country than its income appears to be because of the enormous inequalities between whites and blacks in South Africa. So it's somewhat interesting, and I can't resist doing this, to show what's happened to South Africa and the Preston curve over the last few decades. If you started in 1960, you can see the Preston curve. There's India and China way down the bottom. It's much further over to the left, and South Africa is still further over than it ought to be, but not as far. If we go forward in time, the Preston curve moves up, and South Africa moves with it. 1980 and 1990, South Africa is almost up with the curve, and then in 2000, it just falls off the end of the world. And that's sort of a parable, for what's actually been happening in sub-Saharan Africa. That who knows whether these life expectancy estimates are accurate. We don't really know how many people are HIV positive. but something like this is happening. And what's been happening to global health in the 90s and beyond is much determined by what's happening to AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. Here's another way of looking at the same thing. This is a World Bank picture, which shows GDP per capita in purchasing power parity terms. The blue countries are the rich ones. Green, which is sort of next to blue, are the next level down, then yellow, and then brown and red are the poorest countries. Obviously, the breakpoints are somewhat arbitrary, so you can shade these wherever you like. This next picture, and I'll flip back and forward. So here's the first picture. This is the second picture. The second one is life expectancy. And in fact, these two graphs are remarkably the same. The blue countries are pretty much the blue countries in both. The big changes are between some of the green countries, which turn into yellow countries or orange countries. So that's Russia, Brazil, which change color, go down. So they're going from green in Russia and Brazil down to orange and yellow. And also sub-Saharan Africa, in which the tip of it, which is Namibia, South Africa, and Botswana, are relatively well off, but very badly off in terms of health. The other major landmass that you see moving around there is Iraq, which is, you can count that any way you like, but in the late 90s, it was rich relative to its health. So I'm really now going back to this, to the picture here. And you know, the usual thing economists would do when you'd asked, you know, is this really a tight relationship, or is it caused by some third factor? And in fact, those maps I showed you, if you drew those for telephones per head, or you drew it for CO2 emissions per head, they would look basically exactly the same. Almost any indicator of GDP per head will look the same, and you can't really tell much from these. This is a very useful stylized fact, but of course it doesn't really tell us that income is what's largely responsible for growth. So let's take first differences. So this is the change in life expectancy from 1960 to 2000, plotted against the GDP growth percent per year. And in fact, all of that positive relationship is due to China. And that's China up at the top there. And that regression line is flat if you don't have China in there. And China's not real, because 1960, these are the World Bank data, in which life expectancy in China in 1960 was way lower than it had been in 1950. And it's the Mao's great leap forward, or the great leap backwards, or whatever you like to call it. So many people were dying in 1960. So this was the return to normalcy. This was not actually a real, or it was real enough, but it's not a development-based increase in life expectancy over that period. One of the things, I'm going to talk a little bit more about data quality in a minute, but one of the things that's interesting is if you draw that same graph using United Nations data, it doesn't look like that at all. And that's because the Great Leap Forward has apparently been airbrushed out of the UN data, and you don't get this big collapse of life expectancy in 1960. And it's perfectly legitimate. It's just a question of how many years you average over and so on. But it's certainly stunning if you're a neophyte and you download these data and look at them, and you wonder what in God's name is going on. I mean, the biggest country in the world has wildly inconsistent data. So if we look at these in terms of the numbers, and I will have very few sets of numbers, but these are a few. If you look at what's been happening in the post-war period, and you can compute these in various ways, so I don't want to defend these to death, but they're roughly right. In the 60s, you had these enormous increases in life expectancy, 8.4 on average over a 10-year period. If you go back into the 50s, there were countries that over a 5 or 10-year period had a 20 or 30-year increase in life expectancy. So immediately after the war, there was like this enormous improvement in life expectancy in the poor countries around the world. That rate of increase has been falling over time, and a particularly marked fall in the 1990s, much of it driven by what's been happening in Russia and Eastern Europe and what's been happening in sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, these are the two cases where things have been really going backward. If you look at economic growth, it was also pretty good in the immediately post-war period, not so good through the 80s, But the 90s has been sort of better. This is the sort of pro-globalization statistic, that economic growth in the world is pretty good in the 90s. And then there's this statistic, which I'll talk about a little bit, is that there's economists want indexes all the time. And so it's very difficult to work in two dimensions at the same time and think about health and income as two separate things. And I don't really like doing this, but it's interesting to look at it, which is to multiply life expectancy by average income. And then what you've got is a sort of measure. You're taking GDP per head, and you're multiplying it by the average number of years that people are going to get it, or something like that. So it's sort of like a measure of lifetime well-being in that country, which takes both life expectancy and income into account. And Amartya Sen many years ago axiomatized something that looks like this. We would also have some inequality measure built into it. But if you do that measure, you can see that this has been falling too, but had a better rate of growth in the 90s, essentially because the acceleration in the growth of GDP was enough to make up for the deceleration in the fall, in the rise, I'm sorry, of life expectancy. If you're interested in inequality, it says inequality. The first column is just average life expectancy. And this is sort of an interesting picture, too, because the first number is the standard deviation of life expectancy across countries. Each country is a unit. And you can see that that was narrowing. These countries were getting closer and closer, the sort of convergence with the poorer countries catching up with the richer countries. Again, that stopped in the decade up to 2000, in 2000. Largely, once again, because of what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, those poor countries are poor in income, and their health is collapsing, too, largely but not entirely because of AIDS. If you weight by population, and this is a slightly odd thing to do, I'm assuming everybody in each country has the same life expectancy, but I count China as a lot more than I count Bhutan, for instance, then you can see that you still get very much the same story. There's a convergence which then turns around. The ones that really diverge, and this is a number that's fairly famous and has caused a lot of controversy because different people take different views of this, is the world income distribution. And this, again, I'm not looking at what's happening within countries. This is just across country. But the across country is the biggest component of the world distribution of income. And when you put these two things together, income times life expectancy, then if you do it across countries, there's divergence in both income and life expectancy. So if you take the two things together, countries are just coming apart. The world's getting much more unequal in this space. On the other hand, if you weight by population and look at the number of people, and India and China are doing very well in both life expectancy and income growth, then you're getting convergence across the world. These are different things, and countries are getting further apart. But the average randomly selected two people in the world are getting closer together because two randomly selected people in the world are likely to be either Indian or Chinese. If you plot this, you can see this is per capita GDP in 1960, measured in log scale, and then the change in life expectancy. And you can see whether that relationship is, this is asking you whether the poorest countries are the ones that had the biggest increase in life expectancy. And this is what some people have called the great gift, that rich countries haven't perhaps been very successful in giving aid to third world countries, but they've given them the germ theory of the disease, and they've given them longer life expectancy, and maybe this is what we're looking at here. So is it true? Well, the answer is it's not true if you don't weight by countries, or sorry, it is true. Yeah, it's not true if you don't weight by population, and it is true if you do weight by population, but it's not very strong. In either case. Similarly, you can ask whether the countries with the lowest life expectancy got the biggest increase, and the answer is yes, whether you weight or not. But once again, the effect is not very strong. Okay, so let me push on from that. I've done a lot of exploration using the UN data, the World Bank data, and looking at sub-periods, 5-year, 10-year, 20-year periods, and so on. And if you look at the growth versus the change in life expectancy over longer and shorter periods, that relationship is as often negative as positive. And it's just all over the place. And in some episodes, there seems to be a strong link. In other periods, there isn't. So I called it weak and inconstant, is what I think of it as. You can do the same for life expectancy. You can use child mortality rates or infant mortality rates, and you get very much the same result. On the other hand, if you take the whole 40-year period since 1960 or the 50-year period since 1950, you really do get a pretty strong correlation in the direction in which you would expect, that the countries that have grown the most are the ones that have had the most health improvement over the very, 40-50-year period. And how you interpret that, I think, makes some sense. It's just simply inconceivable that low life expectancy in sub-Saharan Africa has nothing to do with low income. It's just got to be. On the other hand, if you really think that increasing their income a little faster or slower is going to have much effect on health in the short run, or even over 10 or 20 years, then that's also pretty implausible too. And I think that's sort of what's coming out of these data. You need a lot of other things to make this work. Let me also say that the data on this are pretty terrible. The GDP data are probably not much better than the life expectancy data. And just for truth in advertising, I wanted to show you this picture, which sort of horrified me when I first saw it. The left-hand panel, or both panels, have life expectancy on the vertical axis and infant mortality rates per 1,000 on the horizontal axis. This is all United Nations data. The left-hand data come from the five-year period, 1970 to 75. And the right-hand data come from 1995 to 2000, which is basically the last five-year period in which there's full data. And what you'll notice on the left here is that these rings lie along a pair of straight lines down at the bottom, right? Now, you might say, why on earth should that be the case? Isn't it nice when you get a nice linear relationship between things? Well, you get a nice linear relationship between these things because that's the way they make up the data. And basically, there are no data on life expectancy for most of those countries. And the United Nations is plugging the data on infant mortality or child mortality into a set of standard tables and reading off the life expectancy. So you say, well, why doesn't that happen now? Maybe they've fixed this. Well, they haven't actually fixed it. It's gotten worse because they're starting from that. And then they're adding in some allowance for HIV/AIDS. And anyone who's worked with the HIV/AIDS data knows that, you know, in these countries, you've got data from a pregnancy clinic here, a maternity clinic there. You have a couple of demographic surveillance sites, which are used to adjust the data. But no one really has much idea of what the mortality rates from AIDS are in those countries. So it's certainly broken the relationship between infant mortality and life expectancy, but not in a way that necessarily gives you any conformity in the data. So you could say, we're going to throw out all the data for countries that don't have vital registration systems. But if you do that, the game is up, because we're back with the OECD rich countries, essentially. And so you just can't talk about this issue without at least playing with these data, but you have to treat them with a lot of caution. I also want to talk about China versus India, and this is something that Amartya Sen has recently drawn attention to. Let me just show you the picture. What you've got here is, on the left-hand axis, you have the infant mortality rate, and the orange one is for India, the yellow one is for China, and they started out there about 175, 180 back in 1950. They've declined pretty dramatically in both countries. Though almost all of the decline in China happened prior to 1980, and there's been very little decline after 1980. India, on the other hand, has a much steadier pattern of decline. These patterns have nothing to do with economic growth in these countries, and indeed, you could argue, as Sen and Drees have done, that as soon as China liberated up the economy and went for rapid economic growth, they lost their ability to improve public health. It's important to notice this is not the zero axis at the bottom here. This is 50. You know, you can perfectly well get life expectancy down to 10 or 5 or something. So it's still a long way. Sorry, not life expectancy, infant mortality down to 10 or 5. So it's still a long way to go. So it's not true that they just got to the floor and then you can't go any further. It's what is true is that they stopped. And that the economic growth in China after the reforms came largely at the expense of public health, or at least of further improvements in public health. And there's a lot of documentation of how that happened. In fact, you can see that the growth in China was much more rapid after 1980. You can see the pickup in the growth rate in India in 1990 and a general acceleration through the period, but there's no corresponding acceleration in the rate of improvement of the infant mortality rate. So for this, which is like half of mankind, there really is essentially no relationship between growth and improvement. Let me, however, talk about an argument that comes up, which is whether life expectancy or whether life expectancy multiplied by GDP is actually a good measure of what's been happening to welfare. And one thing you often hear is that this great gift from rich to poor countries, the understanding of the germ theory of disease and the enormous increases in life expectancy that have happened in the third world, have much reduced health inequalities around the world. And to some extent, that's right. But what I want to argue, that's not the right way to measure it. So let me give you an argument that some people will like and some won't. Just consider this experiment. Suppose that at the start, in this high mortality equilibrium, which has been there forever, and that's era one, era zero, or time zero, half of all infants die immediately after birth, and the rest live until age 60, which is a sort of characterization of extreme high mortality, poor country. And probably is not far away from what may have happened in hunter-gatherer societies or something. Life expectancy is, of course, 30, because it's half of 0 plus half of 60, which is 30 years. The average child who's born is going to live for 30 years, even though half of them die immediately and the other half live to 60. Suppose, then, there's a big improvement with immunization or clean water or hand washing or something of the sort. And at time one, this is this new period, only a quarter of children die. The rest live until age 60. So you've now got a quarter multiplied by zero plus three quarters times 60, which is, of course, 45. So life expectancy has gone up by 15 years. And it's these huge increases in life expectancy that come from reducing infant mortality that explain how it was possible to get these enormous increases in life expectancy immediately after the Second World War. But, of course, this is not an equilibrium. Now, if I wanted to be a real economist, I could write down a model and tell you what the equilibrium is. But I'm not going to do that. Just assume, just for the purposes of argument, that after a while, women decide they don't need this, have all these babies they had before. So they reduce fertility from 6 per woman to 4 per woman. Now, if you think about what that does, I've chosen the numbers so that in both cases, every woman has 3 surviving children. Before, they had 6 births, half of them survived. Now they have 4 births, and 3/4 of them survive. Once this is settled down, the population structure and everything in those two societies is the same as it was before in terms of life expectancy and the age structure of the population. However, life expectancy has gone up by a lot, and it's very hard to think of that as being a serious measure of this society having gotten better off. Because the real gains here are not really in life expectancy, they're the gains to the women for not having to have as many children and watching half of their children die. And that would be measured much more through the fertility rate or the decline in the fertility rate rather than by looking at the change in life expectancy or the life expectancy multiplied by GDP. The other argument is if you want to add in the longer lives of the children who live, you have to subtract off the lives that would have been lived by the children who now don't get the opportunity to be born because their mothers choose not to have them. And so those are lives not lived, and you can make a perfectly logical case for excluding them just as you're including the ones who live longer. And you get the same answer either way, which is there's no increase in welfare from the increase in life expectancy, but there's an increase in welfare from fertility. So this to me means that although it is true that up until 1990, and to some extent beyond that, the poor countries have had the biggest increase in life expectancy, it's not true that that's as big an increase, big a decrease in international health inequalities as you might think, because life expectancy is not a good measure of international health inequalities when in one set of countries you're operating on infant mortality and the other countries you're operating on chronic disease among older adults. So let me move on to my last substantive topic, which is to think more about this transmission of technology, drugs, and information moving from one country to the other. I've already talked about it from rich to poor countries. Now we want to talk about it in terms of what's been happening between the rich countries, who are the obvious beneficiaries of sort of inter-country trade and transmission of this sort of globalization. One of the hypotheses first put forward, I think, by Richard Easterlin, was that these changes in technology should cause a convergence in international mortality and life expectancy patterns. Because you're in sort of state zero, where no one really knows how to fix this thing, and mortality rates are widely different across countries because some by accident do good things in some countries and others they don't, but no one really knows what they're doing. A new technology comes along which actually helps people figure out how to save lives. Mortality goes down and the mortality rates converge as everybody adopts the new technology. Now, of course, this doesn't have to happen because there's a constant flow of new technology and that'll start widening things all the time too. So actually what happens is more an empirical question. As a starting point, here is the US and Britain for mortality rates for 50 to 64 year olds from cardiovascular disease from 1950 through to 2000. And the yellow line is the US and the blue line is Britain. And you can see that the US used to have much higher mortality than Britain did. Around 1970, something happened, which the most plausible account, I've argued with a lot of people over this, is that it's the widespread adoption of diuretics for hypertension around 1970. In Britain in that period, the early period, these deaths were still rising, these mortality rates. These, incidentally, are age-adjusted within the interval, so there's no age effects going on here. So these mortality rates went on rising until around 1980, when whatever had caused it in the US, most likely treatment technology, was picked up here. And then you get this rapid decline in Britain, and now we're back to the situation where the mortality rates are lower in Britain than they are in the United States. You can see a somewhat similar pattern for women if you look hard enough, but you have to look very hard. I mean, it's not at all obvious that the same thing is going on from women. And the obvious reason for that is to do with smoking. That smoking is a major risk factor for both cardiovascular disease and lung cancer. Smoking patterns are sharply different between men and women. And so we can potentially sort out the effects of behaviors and technology by looking across men and women. I mean, looking across men and women is a very useful way, I think, to think about these problems. And also, so one story is technology, the other is knowledge. And in particular, the knowledge that cigarette smoking was really harmful for you. Now, according to American legend, the crucial date in this is the 1964 report of the Surgeon General, which was, the myth goes, widely adopted by all Americans, the more educated of whom immediately stopped smoking when this report was published, and then smoking was going up until then, and then immediately sort of fell after that. There's also a sort of American joke about this. When Americans travel in Europe, they say it's a pity the Surgeon General's report was not translated into other languages. Because, you know, even here, you come from the United States and you come here and you're immediately struck by the amount of smoking there is around you in a way that's not true in the US anymore. I get out of order at this point. Be back off. Here is the all-cause mortality rates for men and women for the whole OECD. So you put these pictures together, and you see for men just this enormous convergence from these rates being all over the place in 1950 and really becoming quite tightly bunched. And that top one is like Korea, which has come in very late to this picture. So if you took the original countries, there really is a bunching of these mortality rates, which looks like a technology story to me. For women, though, you don't see it. If anything, there's slight divergence in these patterns. Now, if you restrict this to cardiovascular disease, now the story is much better, that you see this much tighter convergence for men, and there's some convergence for women. Now, remember, smoking causes cardiovascular disease as well as lung cancer, so the pressure for convergence that may be coming from the technology, which we see much more clearly in the men who quit smoking earlier, is muted for the women by the smoking behavior. So let's look at the smoking behavior. These are survey data rather than manufacturing data. They're not perfect. They don't always go as far forward as you would like. But this is the prevalence of smoking manufactured cigarettes in the US coming from household surveys, basically. And you can see that peak is around 1964. So this is the Surgeon General story. Well, it turns out, not only did they not translate it into other languages, they didn't translate it into whatever language that women speak, because when you look at this picture, you disaggregate by men and women, you get a completely different picture. This scale is not very good. This is 50 at the beginning, and we're up to 95 or so at the end here. And you can see the men were pretty flat already, but then they kicked down after the report. And the big thing is being driven by women who were rising throughout this period, and women were right, smoking was rising into the 80s, and then has fallen subsequently. So it's, you know, when people look at this, they say, well, this is women's liberation. You know, women were not allowed to smoke before. They had more power, and power included the power to poison yourself. And they availed themselves of that until they sort of caught up with men, or nearly caught up with men, and then the thing went down. This pattern is very similar to the pattern in Britain, which looks sort of like this. In these data, the women have crossed over the men. I looked in the GSS the other day, and they haven't quite, but the graphs are more or less the same sort of picture. And it's a little lower now. It's into the high 20s. Any English-speaking country sort of looks like this. The men coming down, the women going up into the 80s, and then they've sort of more or less caught up, and then they go down together. But as soon as you get away from English-speaking countries, it doesn't look like this anymore. These are the astonishingly healthy Japanese who more or less live forever and who smoke, you know, in huge quantities. So even now with a lot of fall, the men are around 60%. The women never did get to smoke much, and there hasn't been very much change in their behavior. But if you take the Scandinavian countries that are often held up to us as great exemplars of health, they're not doing so great either, with the women decline long postponed. There's Sweden, there's Italy, there's France, there's the Netherlands, Germany. The further east you go, the more likely it is that both men and women are still increasing their smoking. So if this is transmission of knowledge, it's very uncertain, unsure, and there's obviously an enormous amount of resistance. It takes a long time to change habits around there. There's Romania, what was the former USSR, Yugoslavia. And here's all the males together. And you can see there's a coordinated downward movement. Not much convergence, not much divergence either. The women don't look like that at all. The women are just all over the place. And I don't think we have a clue what is driving these patterns. You know, the first thing an economist thinks is about prices. But, you know, the price for men and women for a pack of cigarettes is more or less the same, or at least in terms of money price. So, you know, these sort of things, like a lot of health habits, are not tremendously well understood, both cross-country and across gender in this case. So this is just a summary slide. I think I've said all of this. And so if you look at this in terms of lung cancer, which is the sort of great test of the effects of smoking on health, you can see the original enormous divergence of the men, which has now really begun to crunch down. And that takes a long time because of the long lags between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. And for the women, the divergence is still going on. And there's only a few lead countries where mortality from lung cancer for women has actually begun to turn down. But for most countries, it's still expanding and expanding at different rates. All right, my last topic, I will stop, is I want to talk about failures of globalization and the policy conclusions that come from this. So this story I've just been shown you with all these pretty pictures is a real, you know, these countries are all connected up. And the good things that happen in one get passed on to the other, albeit with long and variable lags sometimes. But, you know, the international transmission is really working. It's also true that immediately after the post-war, as I think I've said several times, there was a very rapid transmission of life expectancy from rich countries to poor countries. That has really stalled in the 90s, and not just because of HIV/AIDS. So that infant mortality rates, when you take out the effects of HIV/AIDS to the extent you can, are still fell much more slowly in the 90s than they had in the 80s. And some people attribute this to the sort of endless chain of vertical programs that the WHO and UNICEF and others have put in place have sort of run out for a while, and no one has a real new one to put in place. And it's clear that this is part of a worldwide slowdown in the 1990s. There's also, as we've seen, the divergence of sub-Saharan Africa, and ECA stands for Eastern Europe and Central Asia, where there was the health crisis too, HIV and AIDS in Africa. And you've got this very sharp contrast in the 90s between this convergence of health in the rich countries and the divergence of health between the rich and the poor countries and within the poor countries. Very, very different sort of things going on. And just to remind one of some of the facts, which are good to look at from time to time, however horrid they are, I mean, this is an enormous failure of globalization. I mean, there are 10.5 million child deaths a year that would not take place if the world were completely globalized in the sense that those children are being born in rich countries. There's 25 to 28 million people in Africa who are infected with HIV/AIDS, and 2.2 to 2.4 million of them are dying each year. Almost none of those are receiving any sort of therapy. And once again, those deaths would not take place were those people living in rich countries. So this sort of globalization, in which we can replicate what happened immediately post-war to deal with this, is either not happening or it's happening extremely slowly. And I think that's the enormous task ahead, the sort of challenge to globalization as to whether we can do something about that. So one final slide. Just to summarize this in terms of policies, the first is not to buy the Pritchett-Summers argument that wealthier is healthier. In the short run, in all but the longest run, we want to wait much too long. We cannot simply rely on recipes of economic growth to solve poor health in poor countries, even supposing there is growth, and there's precious little economic growth in Africa or forecast for Africa. There's therefore no alternative but to take on the enormously difficult and challenging task of addressing health directly in sub-Saharan Africa and in other countries. Many of you here will be well aware of the sometimes bitter debates between those who believe in vertical and horizontal mechanisms for doing that, the vertical ones delivered from international agencies and from outside, and the horizontal ones, the sort of much more popular development of national health systems that are widespread throughout the country. I don't have anything to say about that, but I wanted to put that up because it shows that there are still enormous debates going on about how that can be accomplished. The last thing I want to say is something about protecting poor country health and trade arrangements. And the negotiations for the General Agreement in Trade and Services, the GATS, which is there, are indeed for TRIPS, have not always focused, to put it mildly, on the needs of the poorest countries. There's also been a lot of debate about bilateral trade deals, especially between the United States and other countries, and whether those are in the interests of, let alone American consumers, let alone the health of the people in the countries who are affected by those debates. So those are the challenges. I think the international trade architecture for TRIPS and GATS and these bilateral trade deals needs to take more account of the health of the poorest people in the world. And I think we have to face up to the task of trying to directly improve the health of people in Africa. Thank you very much.
So when Ali asked me if I would make this response to Angus's lecture, it took me about 3 seconds to say yes. Angus and I are old friends. We were colleagues. Actually, we had offices next door to one another for a number of years at Princeton. And I knew I would be in for a great treat to have to study Angus's lecture in the text beforehand and to listen to it. In fact, though, I was trying to think whether I'd ever had to respond or comment on one of Angus's paper, at least in a formal setting, and I don't think I ever did. So it was a double pleasure to now have the opportunity. Moreover, Angus mentioned this is Thanksgiving, and There was particular thanks I should give to Angus on this front. My lecture, fortuitously, on Tuesday in my economic development course is going to be on health. And once I discovered this was a sellout, I also knew most of my students couldn't come, so I would have a particular advantage. You'd be able to use the material in Angus's lecture. Anyway, I think the sort of, if I can say what my sort of take home is from what I learned from Angus's talk, and then I'll add my own 5 cents worth, is that I think we've learned, at least looking at the data, if nothing else, that globalization is not about convergence. It's not about convergence in income per capita. It's not about convergence in life expectancy or any other indicators that we looked at. We tend to look at. The other take-home message I take, and I think the important one, is this debate about whether wealthier is healthier. And I think what Angus has to say on that is very persuasive. And it's the kind of careful analysis of the data that I associate with Angus's work that informs us about so many different questions. So what I'm going to spend a few minutes doing now is to talk about how I made sense of Angus's results and thinking about these issues in general. And I have to find, I assume that's going to work. Yeah, Pete. On the big machine, we're connected to the, all right, I got it. There we go. And I can see what I put up there as well. So at some level, Angus's lecture is about globalization, but it concentrates for the most part on the question about the links between income health, income and health. And in some ways, the most striking table, Angus didn't put it up in quite the form it is in table one of his written text. And is this particular table here. The reason I want to point this table out is the resonance it had with me is that if you look at the top panel, which is change in life expectancy, look at the 1980 to 1990 period where you observe continued improvements in life expectancy, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America. But if you look at the second of these panels, you observe those are periods in which you have economic decline, growth rates of minus 0.5% in sub-Saharan Africa and minus 0.8% in Latin America and the Caribbean. So it's very clear looking at that these countries, at least in that period, continued to progress on this measure in spite of the fact that their economies were not expanding. Now, in some ways, that in a nutshell is part of the wealthier is not healthier message. But I immediately thought, well, how am I to think about these issues? And as some of you may know, my main interests these days are in the area of political economy and thinking about what makes government effective. So I just sort of wanted to think about what are the main determinants that economists would think of are the drivers of health achievement. One is, of course, access to private goods, and many of the arguments that Angus made, of course, are about how, for example, access to nutrition and to basic health services as a private good expand our health potential. The other, of course, is access to public goods. And it's very hard to argue that we necessarily will have improvement in access to public goods from improvements in national income. That's going to depend very much about how we think government is functioning, since we think government is one of the main sources of provision of public goods, and that may or may not improve alongside what happens to income. Indeed, we could have a situation with improvements in the operation of government as a provider of public goods, which needn't go along with an improvement in the production of private goods. The third key factor that I think most of us would say is likely to be an important determinant of health is the extent of market failure. There are a number of contexts, and indeed as long as we've had a separate branch of economics that could be called health and economics, the idea that there are special forms of market failure that occur in the context of health is a key and resounding theme. And of course, if we believe that these were very important determinants of what drives health status, again, there'd be no particular reason to think this would always go along with improvements in national income. We could imagine situations where ability to fix market failures is poorly correlated with that. And finally, something that I think economists have only relatively recently got to grips with, which is what I'll call, for want of a better term, prudential failures. The fact is that people are not as good at making decisions as economists have often thought them to be. There's plenty of evidence that we have very many defective decision-making capacities, and we only have to introspect to realize that, but also there's plenty of emerging evidence. And we might think that these are very important features in the context of health where, for example, the graphs that Angus put up on smoking, if we were to think about the kind of model of human behavior that could generate those data, I doubt that we'd be most attracted to the usual rational, far-sighted model of economic theory. So I will return to that a little bit at the end. But this, you know, when I think, try to make sense of any of this, I kind of make sense of it. If we observe improvements in health, it's probably because one or other of these four influences is at work. Now, Angus in his discussion, most of his discussion, I think focuses on what I would say is the private goods linked to health. He didn't do so exclusively at the end, particularly he talked about public goods. But if public goods and market failures are what are really important in driving access to health, then we ought to be able to see some links in the data, at least, between what you might call the quality of government and health. And trying to understand both how to measure and to think about the quality of government is something that economists have been very active in recent years. Indeed, I think many of us now believe that we can't really think of there being independent variation in national income that isn't ultimately driven by the institutions that society has to enable production of private and public goods. So I was just curious, if I pulled out some data, or at least got my research assistant, in fact, I should be honest about this, to pull down some data and to look at the link between measures of governance and measures of health, what would I find? Sorry, I'm going in the wrong direction, is that right? Yeah. This is what you find. So essentially on the vertical axis we have life expectancy, and on the horizontal axis we have governance measures. Well, what are they? They're essentially, these are drawn from the World Bank, but there's a whole variety of different governance measures out there you can look at. Essentially, they are the average of the following governance indicators produced by the World Bank. They have these wonderful titles, which makes you a little bit suspicious about what's actually inside them. Voice and accountability, political stability, absence of violence, government effectiveness, regulatory quality, rule of law, control of corruption. I mean, this is a case where you really do think the data are rather like sausages, in the sense you might enjoy eating them, but you don't want to know how they're made. But there you have it. And what do you find? I think there's nothing surprising here. The governance and life expectancy are strongly positively correlated. I don't think we would want to infer any causality in any direction from this, just as I probably wouldn't want to infer causality from the income-life expectancy relationship. Indeed, I guess if I was really ambitious, I could try and fit some semi-parametric, rather a lot like the Preston curve, if you look at where the bunching is occurring below the line at the bottom there. Now, why am I raising this? I mean, it's really getting to the heart of the question, where does health come from, either at the national or local level? And what is really the thing that's causing health? Now, I wouldn't claim that governance causes health, but I would claim, I think, that if you were thinking about the relationship between the production of public goods and health, and there are plenty of reasons to think that's very important, I'd want to look at the institutions of governance and to think about how they function in this whole story. So what about globalization and governance, and if we take this seriously? Well, I think there's some interesting issues there. One view is that, in fact, it's governance that enables access to the world economy. And in fact, if you look at the data, I've done this before, you actually find those countries that are, quote, successful globalizers, in the sense of those that have effectively integrated by expanding trade into the world economy, tend on average to be those who score quite well on those governance indicators I gave you, which suggests there's something about good governance that actually is the source of access to markets. It's also interesting to think whether the argument can be run in the other way, and this has certainly been discussed. For example, there was a paper I remember reading that tried to argue that countries with were more open to trade, had less corrupt governments, because somehow this was a discipline device on those governments. But again, if one thinks about governance, there may be some interesting arguments to think about how that interacts with the globalization theme. Finally, I want to talk about globalization and individual agency, this question about whether or not we think that as we open the world up to more and more influences, flows of knowledge, flows of CNN and MTV or whatever it is else that flows across the world in this context, how do we think this will have an impact on individual agency? And I guess I just throw this out at the end, really, conjecture. But I think Angus's discussion of smoking here is very striking. And one thing I've been struck by, and I don't know if this has been extensively studied, is the way in which essentially the, what I might call, for want of a better term, or rather loaded term, big tobacco, is now focusing so clearly on the developing world and the ability to expand its brands into certain parts of the world, and how one wonders how this is interacting with the issues of individual agency and the ability to particularly impression individuals in those parts of the world where governance is very weak. Because essentially, many of the improvements that Angus is describing, I regard as improvements in the way we as societies have chosen to treat these issues. And particularly if we think that poor countries are those that are subject to weak governance, it's going to be much more difficult for them in due course to deal with many of these issues going forward. And therefore, if we believe that individuals are not these perfect, rational, far-sighted individuals that we normally describe, there may be really very severe implications of that aspect of globalization, which I think is worth just putting on the table. So those are my rather random remarks to in the context of what Angus has beautifully connected and developed lecture. But I should say again, it was really a treat to listen to Angus and to read his lecture, and I'm sure, like all of you here, I learned a huge amount from it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks to both of you. We've got some roving mics and a short period of time for questions if people want to indicate who they are and where they're from. We can take maybe half a dozen questions.
You presented the smoking data as if there was no particular underlying reason apart from maybe the ability to read the Surgeon General's report. But I would suggest to you, and pick up on the point that you've made on the slides above, in each of those countries, one can see, often explain what one sees by the interplay, the balance of forces between, on the one hand, the globalized international tobacco companies, and on the other hand, the anti-tobacco advocacy, which is itself increasingly globalizing through NGOs like GlobalLink. And when we looked at, for example, the situation in Japan, with the lottery monopoly, promoting the traditional ways to men, but not to women. In Austria, the privatization of Austria Tabak, the deal with Gallagher's, linked to European Union enlargement, and the changes, the increasing smoking that happened thereafter. Each of those examples, one can explain what was going on there. So in a way, there's an element of globalization that does explain that. But it is this balance which makes it more complicated. Just to link very quickly to the final point about globalization of governance and the tobacco industry, I think we see very clearly in the former Soviet Union that the ability of big tobacco to move into countries is very clearly linked to governance. But it's a rather more complicated relationship, because where it can move in is in those countries where the governance is poor, but is in the hands of one or two people, like in Uzbekistan or Kyrgyzstan or some of the other countries where it has much greater difficulty, is where governance is also very poor, but like in the Caucasus or in Moldova, the power is much more dispersed, and in fact you have a sort of chaotic poor governance rather than autocratic poor governance. So it's the nature of the bad governance that is probably important as well.
Maybe we'll take another question now.
There's another question at the back, and we put the questions together.
Thank you. Becky Sandu from the Department of Health. I have two questions, or a comment on the first one. Angus mentioned policies right at the end, and he mentioned particularly no alternative to addressing health directly and protecting poor countries through trade. I don't see those as policies, I see those as aspirations, and we see the reality that rich countries are not willing to spend money or forgo trade positions to help other countries. But related to the policy question, I wondered whether there was some way poor countries could borrow money to invest in education. The evidence from development economics is education is very strongly linked to health, and building on what you said, health might actually therefore improve. If health improved, income might improve. Would you like to comment on that?
Okay, maybe I'll just take a few of these before we forget them. I agree with that, and this issue about it being an aspiration and not a reality is right. But for instance, there's been an enormous amount of attention focused in the last few years on the implications of goods trade and tariffs and so on among the rich countries for the poor countries. And at least where I sit, I haven't seen the same amount of attention focused on health, though I think it's beginning to build up. And also, some of this is to do with economists and health people not actually talking to each other, because, you know, there are different sets of people own these. And, you know, the health stuff doesn't always get in the economic negotiations. Let me say a little bit about the smoking. I think that's great, and I would like to know more about it. What I think I'm, throughout this lecture, and I think, you know, Tim's point and your point are to do with, you know, sort of filling in the mechanisms that are behind just the raw facts that I showed. And I may indeed have, I'm sure I did overstate our ignorance of what drives those smoking patterns. But I also take the governance point seems to me just tremendously important. And, you know, governance and these mechanisms are some of the plausible ways in which you can break this link. I mean, if you think, or you can build this link between income and health, it isn't really there in the short run, but it really is there in the long run. Because it's impossible to imagine real income growth without education growth, without better governance and so on too. So over the long run, these things really have to move together. But in the short run, it's not income that's driving these things. And it's much more likely to be things like governance and the way that tobacco is dealt with and those public health policies which are linked to governance. On that, I just wanted to say that I didn't really have time to talk about it, but I think the China-India comparison is a fascinating comparison for thinking about those public goods. If you're basically a totalitarian state, in some ways that's very good for public health because you can just order people around, you don't really have to worry about the consequence, and once you let a lot more personal liberty in, it's much harder to do that. And I think the argument would be that, you know, India's caught up to a large extent, and, you know, some of the more progressive states in India now have better life expectancy and lower child mortality than does China, and they've done it, albeit over a longer period of time, but without the truncation of personal liberties that were involved in doing this in India. So thinking about that governance and the way it's done and the implications for other aspects of well-being, including personal liberty, I think are a very important way to think through this. And I really did think of what I was trying to do as somehow giving a tour of the terrain rather than trying to get down to the nitty-gritty of the mechanisms, which I think a lot of that remains to be done. And a lot of it, I'm sure, has been done, and I don't know. It's hard to pull this amount of stuff together into a coherent whole.
Okay, last two questions, really. That's all we've got time for. One here and one other. Maybe three, last three. There were only three hands up. I feel very...
Yeah. Especially against the gallery.
Well, they don't have mics up there, so okay. I think that's...
They can talk loudly.
Yeah. Okay, who's going to go first?
I think over here.
Don't fight over anything.
Hello, my name is Amina Itzisalmi. I'm a junior doctor in Lewisham Hospital. I've spent some time in Cuba, which struck me an example, a slightly peculiar example, because it's a country with a developing country GDP, but with developed country life expectancy. And I was wondering if either of the speakers had an opinion about Cuba in that respect, or in terms of the relationship between governments and health development.
We'll take all three,
yes.
And then. Yeah. Okay, so the person here.
My name is Sujit. I'm a MSc International Policy student here. It's interesting to know that the graphs that you presented has data from the World Bank, so it actually disputes the statement that wealthier is healthier. But also, one of the policies of the World Bank has been to kind of cut down the government spending in health through the structural adjustment programs. So, I mean, what do you say about that?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that question.
The data that you presented here is from the World Bank studies, but whereas what they're advocating for is reduced investment in health, public investment in health.
Okay, and the last one. You'll have to shout, I'm afraid, because there's no mic.
The first speaker, I must congratulate him on his amazing statistical evidence and the power of his delivery. But what struck me was the unfinished business he mentioned of colonization and the failure of the transmission towards his conclusion from rich to poor countries in terms of both health and wealth. And it was quite incredible that when he mentioned Southern Africa in terms of South Africa itself as the wealthiest country on the continent, and Botswana, which has, in terms of a lower relationship of population and wealth creation and the actual wealth within Botswana itself. And how is it that 25 million people within that continental mass, south of the Sahara, are suffering from HIV and AIDS, and the Western system refuses to take note of the fact that so many people are dying, it's coming towards 28 million now. And how is it that the rich north seems to take it for granted that the fact that so many are dying is something in greater is almost irrelevant until the problem becomes further north? Could we clarify the situation there in terms of the failure of the transmission?
Okay, I think that's enough on the questions. That's as sweeping a question as Angus's original lecture, I think, so you might not expect too much.
I wish I knew the answer. I mean, that in some sense was the reason for my penultimate two slides about the failures of globalization, and I meant it. I mean, that this is an enormous failure, that those people who are dying in sub-Saharan Africa would not be dying if they lived in Europe or if they lived in the United States. And that's, you know, Jim Kim likes to say that that is the thing that future generations will judge our generation by, about how we responded to that crisis. And the answer is we haven't responded to it very well, and we made little or no progress so far. And I think that's a great stain on our consciences and on the way the world is organized. I don't know whether in 100 years from now our generation will be judged that way, or whether when this is put in the context of the other great epidemics of history, we'll be judged as having dealt with this well or badly. I think that's very, very hard to predict. Let me say a few words about the two other questions. I do not represent the World Bank, so let me make that clear. Something like, I think more than 25% of the World Bank's current loans are for health. The World Bank is spending a tremendous amount of money on health. It's not always spending it in the way that some of the countries would like. And it's clear that in the early days of structural adjustment, there were truly some terrible disasters that happened as a consequence of that. But I'm not really a great vilifier of the World Bank on health. I mean, it seems to me that it's hard to know exactly what to do, and almost anyone in that position would come in for a tremendous amount of vilification. I think coming to Cuba, which is an interesting case, you know, Cuba in some ways is like China. You know, with a, you can do a lot for public health in heavily directed systems. I think there are other places that in some ways are more interesting in having managed to square that circle better. In places like Costa Rica, almost all of southern India, I mean, Kerala used to be the poster boy, but Tamil Nadu is doing tremendously well. They're beginning to pick up in the West, too. So I don't think it's just Kerala. People used to quote Sri Lanka as a great example until they started tearing each other apart. So it's not quite such a poster child now, but there are places like that. And of course, that's part of the argument that you just can't rely on GDP to solve these problems. You've got to address health directly. GDP may take care of it, but it'll be 50 years from now. And you can't rely on, you know, growth solving this. I mean, that's obvious in the case of something like HIV/AIDS, where there's no way that economic growth is going to solve this. But I think much more generally that's true too. Now, of course, that does leave us in the situation of perhaps not exactly knowing which are the best policies, and with all these other debates in international health about how you deal with those issues. I don't think of the Cuban solution as the one that one would want to adopt all over the world, though. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. One quick announcement before I thank both speakers. There is a reception to be held in the senior common room, which is in the old building. You come out of this building, turn right, first on the right, and it's in Houghton Street if you want to join us there for a reception afterwards more than welcome. That leaves me with great pleasure to thank both speakers, particularly Angus, for covering such a wide-ranging topic with his usual concise clarity and conclusions at the end. Thanks very much, Angus.